From Sounds True, Dr. Quantum presents A User's Guide to Your Universe, Session 5, Time Bends and Space Warps, with Fred Allen Wolf.
Think about this for a while. Can time bend into a circle? Can space warp and waffle as if it were crunched up like a piece of paper you're going to throw away? Is it possible that our whole idea about space and time is not what we usually think it is? Linear time and space going on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Well, that's what we're going to be looking at in this session number 5, Time Bends and Space Warps. Now, to show you how strange it is when you begin to think in terms of time bending and space warping, even scientists, when they were first confronted with this whole thing, were aghast and upset and disturbed. And some of the scientists, for example, found it a little amusing that it was so disturbing and frightening to scientists to consider it. Well, there was a guy whose name was Williams, and he decided to write a poem in the honor of Albert Einstein's visit to the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. This was in 1924. And this is what he said to Einstein at this dinner. You can imagine Einstein sitting there listening, and here's Williams getting up and supposedly to introduce Einstein. And he says, "And space, it has dimensions 4 instead of only 3. The square of the hypotenuse ain't what it used to be. It grieves me sore the things you've done to plane geometry. You hold that time is badly warped, that even light is bent. I think I got the idea there, if this is what you meant. The mail the postman brings today, tomorrow will be sent." "The shortest line," Einstein replied, "is not the one that's straight. It curves around upon itself, much like a figure 8. And if you go too rapidly, you will arrive too late." Woo! Einstein, I'm sure, laughed when he heard this poem, and maybe it'll give you a little smile too. But you see, that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a whole new vision of space and time. Now, time is something we think we know what we're talking about when we think about time. I mean, you know, everybody thinks they know what time is. We have this idea, we look at our watch, we see the little hand go around, tick, 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 ah, that's time. Okay, well, think about this for a moment. One windy day, two monks were arguing about a flapping banner. The first one said, "I say the banner is moving, not the wind." And the second said, "I say the wind is moving, not the banner." And a third monk passed by and said, "The wind is not moving, the banner is not moving, your minds are moving." Whoa, what are these guys talking about? They're talking about time. And they're talking about our experience of time. Well, I want you to, for a moment, to experience time. I don't know, you may be driving your car right now. You may be looking out the window. You're certainly, I hope, listening to me. So for the moment, just look at what you're seeing. And what you're seeing right now, and I'm going to use that word now to indicate something in time, is what you would think is my moment of now, my moment of time. But actually what you're looking at is space. And the space that you're perceiving, whatever is being perceived, what you call now, is what you call now. But it ain't really now, it's space. So now is a perception of space. And the next instant, another perception of space. So we know time through space. Oh, well, that's really confusing, Dr. Wolf. What are you talking about? What we're trying to point out to you is that things aren't so easy when we're talking about time. Time really is kind of confusing, and it has a difficulty when we try to make any real sense of it. One person said, time is that quality of nature which keeps events from happening all at once. Lately, it doesn't seem to be working. So, time is a kind of a mystery. But what we as physicists have done with it is to make it less mysterious by turning it into a line. We call it line time or linear time. And what we mean by linear time is what you would mean when you draw a straight line, like take a ruler and a pencil and draw a straight line. We think of time as something which runs along that line. And we mark off on the line, the start of the line, at the end of the line. We can call that the start 1 and the ending 2. And then in between, we have 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, as we mark off little distances along the line, which separates 1 from 2, the end point from the beginning point. And we can imagine that that is what a clock would show as we move along that line. We call that linear time, and it's very much responsible for our way of seeing time. In fact, physicists themselves began to see time in that way. We can imagine space is also being marked off in a similar way. We can see space as being like a line we draw, and the line we draw, say, from where we're sitting straight out in front of us or going straight out in back of us, we would call one dimension of space. We can imagine another line going from one ear and out the other ear. That would be another dimension of space. And we can imagine a line going from the top of our heads through the bottom of our seats, and that would be a third line. Those would be the three dimensions of space. But in all of that, there's also time. We don't see time like we see these other dimensions. At least we can't even imagine that we see it the same way we see these other dimensions, but we can think about it that way. And that's where the idea of four-dimensional space-time really came in. Now, what's very interesting about all of this is that when we put together space and time by drawing them as if they were the same thing on a sheet of paper. For example, we can say all the line going up the paper is time, and the line coming across the paper is one dimension of space. We have what is called a space-time diagram. Now, we've all heard of Albert Einstein, of course. Well, in 1905, I think I told you last time that Albert Einstein was the inventor of this thing called the photoelectric effect, when he explained that light could actually appear as little bundles, little lumps of light, which were later called photons, and that explained how electrons came boiling off of metal when the light hit the metal. In 1905, the same year he came up with that idea, he also came up with the idea of the theory of relativity. And the word relativity may throw you, because what has relativity got to do with space and time? Well, we'll see what that is in just a short moment. But in viewing this theory of relativity, or coming up with this, Einstein completely changed the way we think about space and time. And that's what I want to talk to you about here, because it will help us understand some interesting aspects of not only quantum physics, which we're going to be talking about, but also how we can travel in space and time, and how traveling in time, forwards or backwards, can even be made possible. But before we get to that point, let me tell you a little bit more about what Einstein had done. Einstein was thinking about light, and he was saying, you know, light has to travel from there to here. If it's going to reach my eye, it's got to come from the lamp, let's say, and it's got to travel, because when I turn the light on, it doesn't just instantly pop into my head, hit my eye. It has to go a certain distance. And he had imagined what it would be like to get up from his chair and sit on a beam of light and ride it. And here's what he was thinking. Now you think about this yourself. You know, I'm going to put you in Einstein's head for a little while. Think about this. Einstein is riding a beam of light, which means he's moving at the speed of light. And he has in his back pocket a mirror. So he takes out his pocket mirror and he holds it out in front of his face at arm's length so that he can see, hopefully see, his reflection in the mirror. The question he asked himself is, would I be able to see my face in the mirror? Could I see my reflection? Now you might think, of course he could see his face. I mean, anybody could see their face by holding up a mirror. What's the big deal? What's the big deal? Well, think about it a moment. In order to see his face, what has to happen? Well, light has to first hit his face. Then it has to reflect off his face. Then it has to travel to the mirror. Then it has to reflect off the mirror and travel back to his eye. All right. So that means wherever the light's coming from, it has to go to his face, back to the mirror, and then back to his face again. So it's three possible things that light has to do. One, two, three, to get to his eye. But he's moving at the speed of light. If he's moving at the speed of light, well, then maybe the light coming towards him from some other place would certainly be speeded up. But then when it reflects off his face, it's also moving at the speed of light. So he is moving at the same speed as the light coming from his face. So he's always moving with that light. And the mirror is, of course, moving ahead of him because it's one arm's length ahead. So just as he's never going to really reach his mirror because the mirror is arm's length ahead of him, the light, which is reflecting off his face, is never going to reach the mirror because it's always running right alongside of him. So as they run along, there's no light from his face ever able to reach the mirror. In other words, he ain't going to see himself in the mirror. When he looks in the mirror, what is he going to see? He's going to see nothing. It's Twilight Zone again, folks. And this is what got Einstein worried. He began to wonder, what is so special about the speed of light that I can make objects disappear if I were just moving at the speed of light? Now, this is what got him thinking, according to him. Meanwhile, back in the ranch, sometime in the late 18th century, I think it was 1880, 1890, I'm not sure of the exact date, there were two guys at the Case Western University in Ohio. These two guys were attempting to measure the speed of light, and what they wanted to do is not only measure it, they wanted to know what would happen if they moved towards the source of light or away from the source of light. Would there be a difference in the speed? That's what they were looking for. And you might think, well, why would there be any difference? Well, think about this for a moment. Suppose you're on a train and somebody who is on the side, on the tracks, throws a ball at you. Well, you're moving at, say, 60 miles an hour on the train. The ball is going to be moving at a different speed relative to you because, after all, the guy may be throwing the ball at, say, 5 miles an hour or something like that. But relative to you, it could have a whole different speed because, after all, you're moving past it or towards it or away from it. And so the change, that speed relative to you could change. And these guys were thinking, well, the Earth is moving and it's moving relative to any source of light. So maybe as the Earth moves, it could see a difference in speed. And what they found out is that no matter whether they were approaching the source of the light or moving away from the source of light, the speed of light was the same. It didn't make any difference. It was always the same speed. The speed of light is the speed of light is the speed of light, no matter how fast you're traveling. This got Einstein thinking. Well, he says he got this before he started thinking about this particular experiment. But nevertheless, the idea occurred to him that if the speed of light is the same for all observers, then how can we explain the apparent disparity that no matter how fast something moves relative to you and emits light, that light is always the same? It doesn't make logical sense unless somehow space and time are not fixed. And this is what Einstein's genius came up with. He said, change what we think about space and time, accept the experimental fact of light, and that will introduce the whole necessary transformation in our thinking that will explain to us how it is that we always see the speed of light moving the same way. Now, this was a revolutionary idea, but it wasn't really time bends and space warps yet. It was close, but there was something else that was needed. And the funny thing about this is that this came from one of Einstein's teachers. And this teacher's name was Hermann Minkowski. And in about 1908, while he was speaking before the German group of physicians and philosophers, it was called the Deutsche Naturforschung, Forscher und Ärzte, the German philosophers and physicians, a body that was used by scientists to disseminate the ideas of their individual disciplines to wider audiences, Minkowski gave a talk called Space and Time. And this is what he said. He said, gentlemen, of course I'm translating from German into English. He said, gentlemen, the ideas of space and time which I wish to develop before you grew from the soil of experimental physics. Therein lies their strength. Their tendency is radical. From now on, space by itself and time by itself must sink into the shadows, while only a union of the two preserves independence. Probably no other scientist other than this Hermann Minkowski, who, by the way, was, as I mentioned, was a teacher of Einstein, created the myth of Einstein. I think this is where Einstein suddenly gets elevated. It's through Minkowski. He was largely responsible for all the early fame that Einstein received in Germany. And Einstein himself described Minkowski's contribution as the provision of equations in which the special laws of relativity take on a new form, in which the time coordinate plays exactly the same role as the three space coordinates, was a revolution. So this is what he did. Minkowski had taken Einstein's idea and created something new, which is now called space-time. Now, the idea of thinking of time as a dimension of space or like space may be kind of strange. Is it really like a dimension of space? It turned out that what Minkowski saw was that it wasn't quite like a dimension of space. It was like, now get this, an imaginary dimension of space. This is another Twilight Zone moment, doodle-loodle, because what it said is that you can write down the kinds of formulas relating sides to each other on a triangle, Pythagorean theorem, all that kind of stuff that you did in high school geometry. You can do the same thing using space-time rather than just space, provided you imagined that one of the dimensions of the triangle, for example, in a Pythagorean right triangle, was an imaginary dimension. Now, what do I mean by imaginary? I mean that it is a number that you get when you take the square root of minus one. Now, I talked about that before. What do I mean by an imaginary number, the square root of minus one? I mean that when you square an imaginary number, the square root of minus one, you get minus one. Now, normally when you square any number, positive or negative, you get a plus number, like minus five times minus five is plus 25. Plus five times plus five is plus 25. But in order to get a minus number when you square a number, you have to use something called imaginary numbers. And these imaginary numbers are very strange. Now, you know the Pythagorean theorem. I'm going to risk that you can use your mind for a moment to imagine what it means to create the Pythagorean theorem, just to give you an idea. You know that a Pythagorean theorem is the relationship of the sides of a right triangle to the hypotenuse. Now, the right triangle is made when you take a line, then you rect another line perpendicular to it. It makes a 90-degree angle between the two lines. And the hypotenuse is a line you get when you draw the line which connects the endpoints of the other two lines. So that's called the hypotenuse. You can kind of imagine that. It's like the slant. You got the two right lines, and then you got the slant. In space-time, one of those lines is an imaginary number. Now, the relationship of the sides to the hypotenuse in a real triangle is the following. If one side has the length A, and the other side has the length B, then the hypotenuse, which has the length C, is equal to, when squared, A squared plus B squared. So C squared is A squared plus B squared. To give you an example, if one side is 3 and the other side is 4, then the fifth side, the hypotenuse, would be 5, because 3 squared is 9, 4 squared is 16, 16 plus 9 is 25, the square root of 25 is 5. So 3, 4, 5 is a typical right triangle. But in space-time, it's an imaginary 3 and a 4, and then you don't get 5. You get something very different, because now you take imaginary 3 squared, that's equal to minus 9. And then you take 4 squared, that's 16. And it's 16 minus 9, which I think is 7, that's C squared. So the hypotenuse actually is less. Now, what does that mean? What it means, and what Einstein was able to realize, is the hypotenuse is actually the line that light would travel if the sides of the two triangles were exactly the same. So if one was 3 and the other was 3, then you have 3 squared, which is 9. You'd have minus 3 squared, that's minus 9. You'd get 0. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What is that saying? That's saying that not only does light have this mysterious property that it's the same for all observers, light itself experiences nothing. The time between the emission of light and the time in which the light is received, no matter how far it seems to go for us, as far as light's concerned, it's zero time. In other words, for light, the birth of light and the death of light is the same event. They both happen simultaneously for light. Not only is that true, but the space that light travels through is also zero. So what we have here is a very bizarre situation in which light has this very mysterious property of appearing and disappearing at exactly the same time, exactly the same place, no matter how far it appears to travel from our point of view. So here we are in this universe in which there's distances, there's space, there's time, there's infinite, seemingly infinite amount of space, seemingly very long periods of time, billions of years, and yet for the light that left the Big Bang, that happened to reach our eyes, which is like for us 15 billion years ago, for that light, the Big Bang and the moment in which it hit our eyes is exactly the same time. This is so mind-boggling. Now, what happens if you start to go at a speed less than the speed of light? Well, then it turns out that the time begins to slow down. Because if it's zero at the speed of light, it's, let's say you're going 0.9999999 the speed of light. Well, then that time interval might be a second. For us, it might be 15 billion years, but for the light or for the thing moving at that speed, it would only be maybe 1 second. If it's going a little bit slower, it might be 10 seconds. If it's going much slower, it might be a year. If it's going at normal speeds like what we travel at, say 5 miles an hour or something like that, it would be close to 15 billion years. So in other words, moving clocks go slow and they stop when they move at the speed of light. And that's what relativity was telling us. It was also telling us that because of this, we had to rethink our whole concept of what space and time are and what and how these dimensions would work. And it also introduced something new. And that's what we're going to explain next. Okay, do we ever really see anything like this kind of weirdness that we're talking about? Time slowing down for moving objects and things of that sort? Turns out there is experimental evidence, a lot of it actually. And in fact, most of the high energy machines that are built have to take into consideration these time shifts, these time dilations, in order to work properly. And even right now, we have global positioning satellites whirling above us. And because they are used to pinpoint where you are on our globe, and because the way you tell where you are on our globe depends really on what time it is, these satellites have to be adjusted continuously in order to take into consideration the time dilation effects due to relativity theory. So this is what is now part of our everyday life. Not only do we have to rethink what we mean by space and time if we're moving relative to another observer who's standing still, because we may experience a beginning event and a final event, and we may be the ones that are traveling between the beginning event and the final event, say we're driving in a car, for example, the person who's watching us follow the same trajectory will say that the beginning event and the final event may have taken place in 5 seconds, whereas we, traveling very near the speed of light, would say it took less than a billionth of a second. So in other words, time and space change according to how you're moving. And that idea then introduced a new kind of notion. It said that if you start off at some place, travel out into space, and then come back to where you started from, you may actually travel on a path through space and time which is curved. Because after all, you went one way, then you had to turn around and come back. So you couldn't have gone on a straight line, because if you did that, you would just keep going. You couldn't come back to where you started from. So if you follow a curved path through space and time, and you count on your wristwatch how much time you actually spent, it turns out that you will actually have spent less time than the people at home who watched you follow this trajectory. This is now known as the twin paradox. You can imagine the following story. Two twins. One stays home. The other one goes off in a rocket ship for, say, what appears to be 4 years. This twin goes off in the rocket ship at, say, near the speed of light, then turns around and comes back, and it takes another 4 years to come back. Twin at home is now 8 years older, but the twin on the rocket ship may have only aged a couple of minutes, because traveling at such a high speed, he didn't really see himself traveling very far at all. In fact, if he had traveled at the speed of light and gone off and come back, he would be exactly the same age when he came back as he was when he started. So all these time dilation effects are very tricky. And what they lead to is that time and space are seemingly inseparable, and that the notion of what is the right amount of time depends on how you move, and that there is no absolute measure of space and time. So even though we say something is this long, a moving observer might see it having a different length. And even though we say it took that long, a moving observer would have a different experience of how much time that took. Now, I would imagine it's pretty difficult for you to imagine all this stuff. Double imagining here. So I'm going to ask you to think of the following situation. Suppose you walk from one end of the room in which you're sitting to the other. Now, let's say you try to walk in a straight line, say from east to west. Now, suppose that you walk in a direction perpendicular to the line you just made, south to north, in your, say, the room you're sitting in. I'm sure you can imagine that you have just walked off two legs of a right triangle, for you could walk back to your starting point by taking the diagonal path from where you are now standing. In this case, both the legs you walked off of form the right triangle, and in this case, both of them are real and they exist in space. Now I want you to imagine that you are in a very strange room. We're going into the twilight zone again, folks. I want you to imagine now that the distance you walk going east and west are ordinary space distances. Okay, no problem there. But suppose the distances you walk going north and south correspond to time, not distance. Thus, when you walk north, you are going forward in time, but nowhere in space. And if you walk south, you are going backward in time, but again, not moving in space. I'm sure you realize that no matter how fast you made the walk, you not only moved through space, you also move through time. But just imagine that you are as in control of time as you are of space. Your room would be a kind of a time machine. Whenever you walk north, time would advance. Whenever you walk south, time would go backward. Whenever you walk east or west, you would go through space, but not move in time. only when you walked off diagonal distances, say northeast or southwest, or northwest or southeast, would you move through space and time together. If you now imagine walking off a right triangle, so that the distance you go east and west is one leg of that triangle, and the time you spend walking north and south is the other leg of that triangle, you will have some idea of what a space-time triangle looks like. Now, what's the difference between the two? The answer is that in a space triangle, since both legs of the triangle are real, in the space-time triangle, one of the legs is imaginary. And that means, as I told you before, it's the time that is the imaginary dimension of space. Strange as it may seem, the mathematical relationship between the legs of the space-time triangle is exactly the same as in the geometry of the space triangle. The only difference is that the triangle being measured has one leg in imaginary space, which we call time, and the other in real space. So all this is very weird, and trying to imagine it, that you have this kind of power to move through space without moving through time, or to move through time without moving through space, may seem strange. But actually, if you think about it, right now, you are sitting in a chair, probably, somewhere. Maybe you are in your apartment building, or maybe you are in your home, or maybe you are driving your car. As far as you're concerned, you are standing still relative to your immediate environment, and time is ticking off. So right now, by sitting still, you are moving through time. How fast are you going? You're going at the speed of light through time. Whoa. Yeah, that's what you're doing. You're actually going through time at the speed of light. And that's what it feels like. Now when you walk off into space, you're moving through space. So when you move through space and time, then you're walking off on a diagonal. And the slower you go, the closer your diagonal is to the timeline, so to speak. So you're moving more in time and less in space. The faster you go, the more you start to move through space more than you do through time. Now, what happens if you're going at infinite speed? When you're going at infinite speed, you're not going through time at all. You're only moving through space. Now, that seems very strange, only moving through space. But what's even stranger is that in quantum physics, that's what we have going on all the time. These things, these waves that I told you about earlier, these waves of possibility are all moving through space at infinite speed most of the time. And in fact, that's what makes quantum mechanics so interesting. Because when things move at infinite speed, it means they're at several places at the same time. And when they're at several places at the same time, it means that things are happening all at once everywhere. And that's called non-locality. And non-locality is also a very weird idea. It almost seems crazy, but it means that things are connected even though they don't seem to be connected. And quantum mechanics, quantum physics, tells us that we are connected in ways that go faster than the speed of light to all things in the universe. And the job is to see just how those connections affect our everyday life. There's a lot more to be told here about space and time, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about how we can use the time bending and space warping effects to talk about how a black hole gets constructed and how wormholes get constructed. And we're going to see how those, in effect, lead to a new kind of time machine. That's coming up.
This concludes Session 5. Our program continues with Session 6, Sex, Magic, and the Shamanic World, with Fred Allen Wolf.
What does sex, magic, and the shamanic world have to do with quantum physics? Well, that was the question I asked myself. And that's what we're going to be talking about in session 6. The story you're about to hear is really a very personal story. It's my story. It's what happened to me. You see, it's how I learned about shamans and what they did. And it also was my beginning of my search into the relationship of physics, particularly quantum physics, to the world of human experience and psychology, and, if you will, to the whole universal view we presently have. To tell this story, I spent several years visiting shamans and shamanic researchers in several places in the world. I went to Great Britain. I spent time in Switzerland. Yes, Switzerland. There are shamans there too. Throughout the United States, Brazil, Peru, and Mexico. I also went through initiatory and ceremonial experiences. These experiences were led by New World shamans, consisting of Native Americans, Indians in North America, and especially in the Amazon jungles of Peru. In my earlier experiences in the shamanic world, I also spent much time in India, Nepal, Europe, and Great Britain. And in Great Britain, in fact, I met shamans that were practicing the old pagan ways. They called it the Way of Weird, W-Y-R-D. Now, the background for this story, in fact, the most eventful things that occurred to me were things that took place in Peru, because it was there that I met three or four, probably even more, shamans who were what are called ayahuasca shamans. These are shamans that use ayahuasca in their ceremonies in order to induce a change of consciousness. This ayahuasca, which is called the vision vine, is a substance that grows in the high and mid-Amazon jungle regions of Peru and other parts of South America. And it's used by Peruvian shamans often as a purgative. In other words, it's the equivalent of what the Catholics call purgatory. It purges you of not only the insides of your stomach, but it also purges you of ideas and concepts that are holding you back from realizing your true human nature. My experiences with these ayahuasca shamans was very, very powerful, and it gave me new hope and new insights into unlocking the secrets of the unconscious mind and bringing these secrets to the light. And it also gave me some insights into how psychology and quantum physics can actually overlap. It also gave me new hope for the eventual curing of a number of pandemic illnesses, including drug addiction problems and psychological illnesses in the Western world. Okay, so that's just a brief introduction, and I'm going to take you into the story right away. Just want to give you some idea as to what the word shaman means. Most of us have been exposed to shamans, although not exactly the way that I would like you to be exposed to them. If you think about any of the movies you've seen where they're Ooga Booga guys, you know, these are guys from primitive villages. I'm thinking of the movie, for example, King Kong. And there, you remember when the guys get off the ship and they go into this native surroundings, and there's the shaman there who's telling him that we got this big guy, and you see these huge gates, and King Kong, this huge gorilla, comes through the gates. The guy who's leading the ceremonies, that's a shaman. Well, that's what I would call the Hollywood version of a shaman. That is really what shamans look like when you meet them. The word shaman actually comes from the Ural Mountains in Russia, and it applies to people who acted in non-ordinary capacities in their tribal situations. What they would often do, in fact, is go into trance states, go into this purgatory world, this nether world, this underworld, if you will, talk with spirits, and come back out with solutions to the problems that were plaguing the tribe at that time. And so all shamans were also taught by shamans. And the one thing I want you to know about shamans, although some may disagree with this, all shamans are born, they're not made. You may want to be a shaman, and you probably could be a fairly decent one, but if it isn't in you from the start, if you haven't gone through what is called in very early youth initiatory experience, it's more likely you're not going to be a very good shaman or not even a shaman at all. These shamans seem to have gone through terrible traumas in their earlier stages of life, and it's because of those traumas that they've gone through that they're actually able to withhold and withstand the visions that come from going into these other realms of existence. All shamans have healing power, although there are different kinds. In the Spanish language, we speak about two kinds of shamans. One kind is called a brujo or a bruja. The bruja is a feminine. The brujo is the masculine form, and it means a kind of a magician, somebody who goes into the dark regions of magic and does kind of the dark magic. We'll touch on the dark regions from time to time, but mostly they're interested in healing and working spells that will help you adjust to and transform as a result of some illness you're trying to get through. Whereas the brujos and the brujas, they're more interested in, I don't like that guy, he did me a dirty. And they're the guys you go to who then cast the dirty spells to make the other guy feel bad. So that's what they do. And sometimes when you get caught by the dark force, as the movies used to tell us, it's very hard to get out of it because it's very powerful when you can induce harm to somebody else. And there's this third kind, which are the kinds of shamans which are the curanderos. These are the ones that only work with light. They're only interested in using the vines and the medicines to cure you, to get you through. They're not interested in the dark side at all. And they're not, in a sense, really shamans, because shamans, you have to kind of dance the line between the dark and the light in order to do their magic. So this is the story. And the story, as I said, is kind of a, you might call it an intuitive physicist quest. To imagine this, you've got to imagine me in the 1980s. I'm a kind of a nudnik physicist. It's kind of like Woody Allen meets King Kong. I mean, it's the kind of vision I have of myself going into this jungle region. I wanted to know how shamans did what they did. So whatever it was, that's what I wanted to know. So what I remember, I was living in Mexico at the time. I just finished writing my book, Parallel Universes. And I was thinking about my next book. And the thought occurred to me, possibly in discussion with my wife at the time, that maybe I should do a book called Shamanic Physics. The idea seemed almost ludicrous to me. Shamanic physics, what the heck can that mean? But it was ringing in my head. And when I then left Mexico after finishing writing the book and traveled back into the United States and gave a talk in Dallas, Texas to a group of people, at the time there were some book publishing people there. And I was talking to some of them. They were asking me about what my next book was going to be. And I said, Shamanic Physics. Well, they wet their pants. They got so excited. They didn't know what to do. Oh, that's it. Oh, boy, that's great. Can we get it? Can we do it? I mean, I never saw such excitement. I thought, what the heck's going on here? Why are these people so excited? So they weren't my publishers. So I went to my publisher and said the same thing to them. I'm going to do a book on shamanic physics. And they all go, oh, well, that's it. You got to do it. And I mean, it was the only time I've ever submitted a book proposal that was much, much shorter than I usually write, much, much less detailed. I usually write a very detailed proposal. And these publishers went nuts. And they gave me more money to do shamanic physics than I did any other book. Well, the shamanic physics book eventually emerged as The Eagle's Quest. And there are many reasons why that particular story unfolds. But let me tell you more about these jungle experiences. As I was leaving Peru, this was after I've been through a tremendous amount of magical experiences, which involved my whole being, my sexuality, and my interaction with these shamans. I had begun to think over how my experiences there, which had far bordered on a kind of a magic that you may be familiar with, it's called synchronicity. There were synchronicities so abound in this that I can't even tell you how bizarre and strange they were. Let me just tell you this one. Here I am in Lima. I'm just about to fly out to go back to the United States. Okay? And while I was in Lima, I thought back of what happened to me just 4 or 5 days before. Just before I came to Lima to leave, I was in the jungles. I was actually in Iquitos, and I was going to take a plane from Iquitos back to Tarapoto, where I was going to be doing some more shamanic ceremonies. I got on the airplane, and the airplane doesn't move. I've just now been through a number of ceremonies in Iquitos with a powerful shaman, and I'm still in a very shamanic state of consciousness at this time. I'm sitting in this airplane, and it doesn't move. It's quiet. I look around at all the people. The plane is full of people, Peruvians, waiting to take off. This plane is supposed to fly to Tarapoto. I'm sitting there waiting. It doesn't take off. Nobody's talking. What is going on? The stewards and stewardesses, which are walking up and down, are not saying a word. There's no announcements. All I hear is a wind blowing on the outside. Now, winds come up from time to time in the jungles of Peru, but this was really rare. This was a rare wind. In fact, the shamans call it El Viento de la Ayahuasca, the winds of ayahuasca. This was a strange wind, and because it was blowing, they were afraid to take off. So I finally, in my poor Spanish, asked, what the hell is going on here? Why aren't we leaving for Tarapoto? And they said, this plane is not to go to Tarapoto. What? No, this plane is not to go to Tarapoto. It is going to go to Lima. I thought, what is going on? We cannot go to Tarapoto. That's all I heard. Finally, the plane leaves and we fly not to where I'm supposed to go, but to Lima, which is very strange. But the minute I arrive in Lima, there are people greeting me at the airport. Who are these people? They had heard that my plane wasn't going to Tarapoto, that I was coming to Lima. That meant I had 4 or 5 days extra in Lima that I wasn't planning on, because I was planning to go to Tarapoto to do more shamanic ceremonies with a shaman in Tarapoto. These were filmmakers. Filmmakers? Who had made a movie called El Viento de la Ayahuasca. And they wanted me to see the movie. I said, huh? What? They were the filmmakers. And I said, okay. So I went with them just after checking in my hotel. I went with them the next day, actually, in the afternoon, and went to see this movie, which was in Spanish, but had just been subtitled in English. And who do I see in the movie but none other than the shaman I was just with in the jungles of Iquitos? He's in the movie. He's playing a part. And this is funny. He's a shaman. He's playing the part of a playboy. This is really bizarre. And what is the movie all about? The movie is about a gringo who comes from Lima, who travels into the jungles of Iquitos, where he meets this beautiful, sexy girl called whatever her name was, Nexi. And Nexi has been cursed by the Acunas, the pink dolphins which swim in the Amazon River in that part of Iquitos. And because she's been cursed by them, she is under their spell. And this guy is under the spell of Nexi. And he is trying to figure out what to do to help her. And in order to help her, the shaman who is leading them and trying to cure Nexi tells him he's got to go through this whole experience of taking ayahuasca, doing the experience, and whatever. Now, he's a gringo. In fact, get this, he's a college professor. Now, I'm looking at this movie that was made 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and made by a Peruvian filmmaker, just about to be released in Mexico at a film festival, and looking for a film distribution in the United States. And the story I'm seeing on the screen is so parallel to what just had happened to me that I can't believe it. Because when my story starts out, I'm in New Mexico. I am looking at my bookshelf. I had just moved into a house which had more space than I had before. So I decided to take all my books out of storage from where they were stored in San Diego. And when I got all my books to my new house in New Mexico, up in the mountain regions where coyotes were abounding, and I could hear them at night, while I was moving in, I had more books than I could use. I decided on the spur of the moment, by the way, I'm starting to do my research for the book on shamanic physics. And while I'm about to move in and I'm looking at all these books, I decided I better get rid of some of these books because I'm not going to use them anymore. So I look into the yellow pages of the phone book. I looked for a bookstore that'll buy used books. And one stands out. It's called the Blue Moon Bookstore. I look out the window at that time and there's a huge blue moon shining in my window. So I think maybe I should call the Blue Moon Bookstore. I call the Blue Moon Bookstore. They said, yeah, we'll come up and buy your books. The next day, they come up in the morning. They look at all the titles of my books and say, you know, these are really strange titles. You have books here on magic. You have books on physics. You have books on musical compositions. You have books on India. What the heck do you do? I said, well, I'm a physicist and a writer. And what I am doing right now is I'm writing a book about shamans. Now, here's the owner of the Blue Moon Bookstore who comes up. Not just an ordinary person. The owner comes up. And she says to me, oh, by the way, do you know there's a Peruvian shaman in town right now? I say, huh? What? Yeah. And I know where he is. Oh, really? Where is he? He is, now, I am the Woody Allen college professor, Nudnik, who has, you know, not done ayahuasca, not even knowing at that time that I was going to Peru, nothing like that. Here this Peruvian shaman is in town, an ayahuascaro shaman, a guy that uses these ayahuasca, and I'm told where to go. So here's a number, call this number. I call the number, a woman answers the phone, and she's very unfriendly. I say, I'd like to meet and discuss shamans and what shamans do and ayahuasca and all that sort of stuff. Can I come over and meet and talk to the shaman? She says, well, yes, you can, but you can't stay for the ceremony because we're already full up. You only 5 minutes. It's all you can have. I said, okay. So my wife and I leave, go over to the house, meet the shaman. His name is Jorge Gonzalez Ramirez. Now, Jorge looks nothing like you would think a shaman looks. Got curly black hair. He's short. He's about 5'6". Nice guy. Doesn't speak a word of English. So one of the people there was able to translate. So immediately I start talking to Jorge and I say, well, tell me, what do you do? What is a shaman? I mean, dumb question, you know, typical dumb kind of questions. And I said, well, how does a shaman really work? I mean, what is it that you're, how does it work? I mean, what is it you're looking for? How do you do this? And he says, I look for vibration. And I said, huh? Vibration? What are you talking about? What do you mean vibration? And he says, I'll show you. And he grabs my wrist and starts feeling my pulse. So I'm thinking, you know, dumb shaman, you know, vibration. He means pulse. I mean, what is vibration? Schmibration. He means pulse. It's just maybe a translational problem, whatever. He says, oh, so you mean pulse. He says, that too. So that too. You mean there's more than just this pulse that you're feeling? And then I'm finding out that he's tuning to a whole number of different vibrations in my body, not just my pulse. I think, whoa, that's pretty powerful. What is he talking about? And so I keep asking him, and he says, you have to stay tonight for the ceremony. He points to me, puts his finger in my face, and says, you have to stay. Now, I've just been told by the woman whose house that this shaman is visiting that I can't stay. But he says, you have to stay. She shuts up. That evening, I'm in ceremony. And I'm one of the first two people to take the brew, the ayahuasca shaman. Now, I'm in a house in New Mexico. And the shaman is giving me this drink, which looks like a wicked brew. It's like the thickest prune juice that you can imagine. It looks disgusting, but I drink it. And I sit down, and suddenly Jorge starts explaining that even though, and this is funny, he's talking in Spanish, but somehow I'm understanding. I don't understand how I can understand. He says, even though we're in New Mexico right now, I want you to imagine that you are now in the jungle and that this is a jungle experience. And then I hear sounds. I hear the sounds of animals, which are sounds you would hear in a typical jungle experience in the equatorial regions around Iquitos, in the Amazonia, the Amazon jungle. And I don't understand how I'm hearing it. Meanwhile, the ayahuasca is taking an effect on me. 30 people were in that ceremony at that time. The other 25, some of them had experiences. Most of them didn't have any experience at all. But me, wooey wow wow. As the ceremony is going on, the shaman begins to sing a song. It's called an Ícaro. And it is a song that I've heard a million times before, yet never have heard before in my life. But I recognize it. How would I recognize? I don't know. But I know that I've heard it before. And later on, I find out that this song is 1,000 years old. It's the song that the shamans from Peru have been using all these years. It's the song that the shamans sing. It's the sacred chant that they sing while you're taking the ceremony, while you're in the ceremony. So while he's singing this song to me, this is in New Mexico now, he comes up to me and I look at him and he's 6'6" tall. He's got very, very dark skin. He's practically naked and he has in his hands a golden sphere. And he says to me in perfect English, I'm going to give you this sphere. I'm going to put it in your heart. I'm going to reach into your heart and take out from your heart the sphere you presently hold. He reaches into my chest and pulls out a dark, ugly ball of something. I don't know where it was, came from. Puts this golden ball into my heart and then goes to the next person. Now, I just told you what he looked like. He's 5'6" tall. He's short. He's a little, you know, kind of roly-poly. Looks nothing like a 6'6" naked Indian shaman, but that's what I see. Meanwhile, the ceremony goes on, and more of this is going on. And finally, when the ceremony is all over and this has all been passed by, he comes up to me and he says, do you now understand? And I said, what was I supposed to understand? He says, that was a special ceremony just for you. That was my teaching ceremony. And now I want to tell you something else. You are going to come to Peru because if you think that was powerful, I want to introduce you to my shaman. He's more powerful than I am. His name is Don Solon. And Don Solon is the most powerful ayahuasca shaman in the whole country of Peru. I want you to come and meet him. Whoa. Whoa. Blue moon. Whoa. I mean, where is this coming from? I mean, I had no idea that any of this was going to happen. I was supposed to be doing a book about shamanic physics. I barely had any notion I was going to go to Peru, but that's where I end up. I'm now in Peru. Now, all this is coming to me while I'm actually in Peru, recalling this whole story of how this all happened. My mind then drifted back to the movie itself. And I remember as I was watching the movie, I was watching the plight of this gringo professor, whose name is Miguel, and listening to what the shaman, whose name is Melitón, who tells Nexi that she must spend some time alone. But Miguel is upset. He has fallen in love with Nexi, and he doesn't want to leave her. He sees in her the mystery that symbolizes the merger of the worlds from which he comes, the sophisticated science, and the mystical world of the Indian from the jungle. She kindles in him a dream of his own redemption. Miguel had not realized how he felt when he followed her and followed the shaman Melitón. Miguel had not realized that he was being captured by the depths of the jungle. He did not know he was actually following a path to his own destiny. and that Nexi was part of that destiny. Nexi is inhabited by the spirits of the jungle, but to Miguel, she herself is becoming a spirit of the plant ayahuasca. She is the remembrance of the dark feminine intuitive self that he feels only dimly aware in himself. And in the strange way, as I watch this movie, after I've just been in the jungle and met Don Salone, the shaman that Jorge Gonzalez referred me to, I realized that my path was very similar. Not only had I gone to meet Jorge, who later had led me into my own soul, but I had also met the feminine spirit of ayahuasca itself. I had met my own version of Nexi. It was innocent, I thought. I mean, who was this spirit that entered my life? I mean, here I am. This is a very young girl. And I mean, you know, this is 1989. I'm now in my 70th year telling you the story. So what is that? That's almost 15 years ago. So I'm in my 50s. Compared to her, I'm an old geezer. I mean, here I am in this beautiful, sexy girl sitting next to me, flirting with me, what it seems to be flirting with me, or maybe she's just naturally friendly, I don't know. And I, what is going on? I mean, what is this beautiful Peruvian spirit whose name was Nonoy, another N-word like Nexi, sitting next to me telling me all this stuff? And so that was my story. I had arrived at the airport and had gone to see a museum where there were stories about various things. And then I had gone to a ceremony and had met this girl, this wonderful spirit. Just after I arrived in Peru and Jorge met my airplane, he immediately took me to another shaman whose name was Wilfredo. And Wilfredo was, I don't know how to call him, he was a mischievous type of shaman, and he took one look at me, and he kept winking at me. You know, like those lewd winks that you get? What the hell is that all about? I mean, I was just as amazed. And he said, drink this. I said, what do you mean? What, drink this? What is this stuff? He says, it'll make you powerful. And he gives me this, you know, when you want to show an erection, you raise your arm up like this, and he pats his arm and raises it up, showing, make it hard. What the hell is that? What do I care about that? You know, I'm here to learn. I'm here to take ayahuasca. What is this got to do with sex? I mean, what's going on here? So I can't figure out why this is being brought to my life. Why does Jorge bring me to Wilfredo, who seems to be manic about sex? And all this stuff is going on. I cannot understand why. And so waiter Wilfredo offers me a drink of this pulga and tells me that I won't be able to sleep tonight, but is going to help me in the ceremony. I'm so blown away by this. What the heck is this all about? Well, that night, ceremony starts. And Jorge introduces me to another younger shaman whose name is Jose Campos. And Jose and Jorge that night are going to conduct the ceremony. So we're led out into the jungle around Tarapoto. We haven't even got to Don Salone yet. We're led out into the jungle in Tarapoto, and it was about 8 o'clock at night or so. And it always gets dark around 6 in the jungle because you're right near the equator. So it's like 6 to 6. It's almost evenly spaced between light and dark, no matter what time of the year it seems to be. And so there I was in the dark jungle. Jose, then this other shaman, arrives, and he's got a bunch of young people with him. And one of them is a very pretty young Peruvian woman. And he introduces her. Her name is Nonoy. And I was totally struck by her beauty and her innocence. She was probably maybe 19, 20 years old. I don't know. And then Jorge says, vamos, we are going. And so we all grab various things for a short walk into the surrounding forest before embarking on the pathway into the jungle. And we're walking along and so forth. And the moon starts to rise a little bit. And it's going from the hot, humid, like being in a steam bath day, into the chill of the night. And it gets cold in the equator in the jungle. Believe me, it really gets cold. It must get down into the 60s. And after being in the 90s in Tarapoto in that heat, it started to feel kind of good. So the moon was overhead and on the ground. We were walking along in single file or in pairs, and some were talking and some weren't. And I was watching the stars of the southern hemisphere, because that's what you see overhead. And the Southern Cross was quite apparent. And I was wondering, did this have some effect on the Spanish conquistadores when they came and they saw the cross of Jesus in the sky? Who knows? So we soon arrived at the grounds where the ceremony is to take place, and we had carried various things with us, portable cushions, mattresses, anything that we could sit on or lie on, because we were going to be on the floor of the jungle, which made me a little nervous, because there are, you know, snakes and creepy crawly things in the jungle, and I'm a very fastidious, you know, boy. I don't want to sit on all that doo-doo. Anyway, we had to sit in all the doo-doo anyway. So we're on the ground sitting in a semicircle around the altar that the shamans had built. And I was delightedly surprised to see that Nonoy was sharing my cushion with me, sitting right next to me. Now, I didn't ask her to sit there. I didn't, you know, wolfishly, even though my name is Wolf, go up and sit next to her. She sat down next to me. Maybe she thought I was a grandfatherly, safe kind of guy. I don't know. But anyway, there she was sitting next to me. And I, you know, I'm still very much a guy. And when a young, beautiful woman sits next to you, you just got to notice. I mean, it's the way we're built, Gales. We notice. We just can't help it. We notice. And this woman is distracting. It's hard for me to pay attention. And then I think, Wilfredo, you dirty old man, you gave me that pulga, that stuff in the afternoon. You knew this was going to happen. I could not figure out how all this was going on. But anyway, here I was sitting next to this delightfully cute, sexy woman. And the ceremony begins. And there's the usual stuff going on. And Nonoy was given the first bit of ayahuasca, and then I was. And I drank it very quickly. And we're sitting around looking at things, and I got up for a moment and started shaking my head to then sit down again. And she was smiling at me and began to tease me about my broad-brimmed hat. I was wearing a hat that I had gotten from Australia, and it was a very broad-brimmed, and she called me a cowboy. And immediately, I'm thinking ayahuasca and sex. I'm thinking, oh, boy, I'm going to score tonight. I mean, that's girls and boys, that's what happens to you guys. We just think like that. It's part of our brain chemistry. I don't know. I mean, I'm a spiritual guy just like the next guy, but that's how guys think. And that's what I was thinking. And I think, what is going to happen? Am I going to score? What's that? Da 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 da. I'm going through all this kind of confusing sex talk in my own head, and I'm getting all turned on. And so this ceremony goes on and on and on. And all sorts of things are going on. Shamans come out, and then they start doing a strange thing. They take some kind of brew in their mouth, I don't know what it was, and they walk up to each of us and spit in our faces. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing. They have somebody come up to you and spit at you. Stuff is all over your face. What is going? I mean, this is the strangest ceremony I've ever been in. Meanwhile, I'm getting stoned. I mean, the ayahuasca is having its effect. And I'm still thinking the kind of thoughts about Nonoy. This is the girl sitting next to me. All this is going on. And I'm hearing this chant going on. The chant is going on. Jose is now chanting, and he's singing a song. And the words are very simple. Noi, 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 noi. And I'm hearing no, 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 no. I'm hearing no, 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 no. He's singing to me, don't do no, no. But he's singing it to everybody. And I'm hearing these words. And I think, what is going on? What is he? Is he really saying no, 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 no? I mean, what is going on? These are the things that are going on in my head. It's so bizarre. It's like I'm being told, you're going to be tempted, but you've got to learn to control this. You've got to learn something about you, about your sexuality, about what's going on inside of you. You've got to get in touch with your feminine soul. Nonoy has been there. She is part of the magic. She's there to teach you about your sexuality. She's not there for you to get in her pants. She's there for you to get in your own pants and find out what's going on inside of you. What's the magic that's taking place there? And that's really what the lesson was. Now, I couldn't quite get that. I mean, I wanted to, but I couldn't quite get that. It took me a while. Finally, as I was leaving the jungle on one of the days to fly to Iquitos, with Jorge and the others. I'm standing in line, and this is now I'm leaving Nonoy at this time. I'm standing in line, and I'm in a crowd, and there are a bunch of Peruvians behind me, and I'm standing there. Now, I want to tell you, Peruvians are normally very gentle, very courteous, very quiet. They're not disruptive. They're not jostling. They're not in a hurry. I mean, the epitome of the opposite of that would be like the typical vision we have of New Yorkers at Macy's on a sale day or something like that. They're not like that. But here I am in line, and I've just been through the ceremony. I haven't quite gotten the message yet. And here I am in line, and suddenly I'm being pushed from in back. And I turn around, and there's a drunk Peruvian couple in back of me. And they're swearing at me in Spanish. And they're pushing me, and they're elbowing me, and they're da-da-da-this, and da-da-da-that. Now, what the hell's going on? I mean, it's so bizarre to me. You know, I've had ayahuasca now, so my mind is not what you would call normal. I was starting in this kind of like other kind of world. This seems so bizarre to me. And I'm thinking, what is going on? And finally it dawns on me, these aren't people behind me. These are the spirits of the jungle. They're still with me. And as soon as I recognize that and begin to recognize what it is I'm supposed to learn from this about my sexuality, I immediately say to the spirits, I got it. I apologize for not understanding what gift you had given me by placing Nonoy next to me in the ceremony. Now I understand. And the minute I said that to myself, everything got quiet. The drunken couple behind me, I looked at them. They were smiling at me. They were not pushing me. They were smiling at me. In the next 5 minutes, the gate is open and we get on the airplane to fly to Iquitos to continue my journey into the world of sex, magic, and shamanism. Well, just in case any of you are wondering what that story had to do with quantum physics, let me give you a few highlights. The first thing that I realized was that shamans do work with a sense of a higher power. And when I got into that with them, what they basically were telling me is that this higher power was essentially the same thing I was referring to when I was speaking about the realm of possibilities out of which everything arises. Further along this, when I asked shamans what in heaven's name is everything made of, and universally, and regardless of whether the shaman I was talking to was from the shores along England or in the California hills with Indian shamans, or whether they were Hawaiian kahunas, or whether they were Mexican shamans, or whether they were Peruvian shamans using ayahuasca, they all said the same thing. Everything is made of vibrations. And as I told you before in the beginning of this, we are dealing with quantum physics, which is really the vibrations, I guess it's called sine qua non, the vibrations above all vibrations that ever could exist, the vibrations of something invisible out of which everything that we see comes into being. And lastly, the one thing that shamans pointed out to me was something that was almost obvious, but I didn't realize it until they actually said it to me, was that shamans choose to look at things, and they choose what they believe to be a physically meaningful story. In other words, they go through the process of connecting up the dots in a quantum way. So what happened before, what happens now, what happens in the future is something they choose to see in a certain way, so that mythology and stories which weave into their tale about who and what you are may be different than the mythologies and stories that you tell yourself when you figure out who and what you are. There's more, of course, and there are some things I couldn't figure out in terms of a quantum physical model because so much of what shamans do is magical. But if there is a science of magic at all that could even approach what shamans do, it's got to be quantum physics.
This concludes Session 6 of Dr. Quantum Presents, A User's Guide to Your Universe with Fred Allen Wolf. Our program continues with Session 7.